one, my Queen of Hearts. Treason to Carly that I should even waver. Which rates the greater score in love, the queen or the ace? How about hearts versus diamonds? To those who'd misread me as a gold digger, I suppose Carly was my queen of diamonds. After my birthday shower, during which I cried a Venetian canal, I went out and ate an uncharacteristically enormous breakfast at a place on Columbus Avenue that Carly and I had never set foot in, or at least I hadn't. It was a fern-filled bistro renowned as a hetero-dominant pickup bar in the evenings, a young mother's rendezvous after another kind of pickup, that of the kiddies from preschool. So it was still mostly empty when I took a booth by the window and found on the seat one of those thick, shiny architecture rags that have so far survived the encroaching death of print. In a state of pure sloth, I paged through it without much interest while I waited for my Lumberjane special, pancakes, eggs, yogurt with pine cone granola, more calories than I generally consume in an entire day. Just as I was about to toss the magazine aside, I happened on a spread showing a house tucked into a hillside overlooking a meadow confettied with flowers. Desirable as it might have been, it wasn't the house that sent blood rushing to my face. It was the headline, or really just the name. View becomes vision, another Austin Kepner gem. I read every word of the article, and at the end, I looked into the face cameoed against another picture of the house and said, "So there you are." Here he was, a man I had met only once in passing, decades before, yet for whom I had dreamed nothing but daggers. Was Kepner my Jack of Spades? I consider it no insult to Carly that I am on a mission to avenge, if not track down, Issa.
Can you read us a bit from a different narrator?
Sure, I'll actually read from Brecht, and he is, as I said earlier, the young man who's come back from New York in a state of shock and stress after having just survived one of those domestic attacks. I'm going to take a sip of water, though, first. Okay, and this is actually almost the very beginning of the book itself. Like every basic Saturday night, the windows in my room are shaking in their frames. Not an earthquake, but my stepfather's music. He stays up way late and plays it so maxed up, basso profundo, that the walls in the living room vibrate clear to the third floor. It pumps through my veins, frazzles my nerves. He gets a river of random heritage tune shop flowing along, thumpa, thumpa, thump. Everything from Nina Simone to Code Dread. And whether there are guests, or it's just him and mom, or even just him, he dances. Austin is a dance maniac. He says dance is his number one narcotic. But sometimes he also breaks out that champion leaf he gets from he won't say where. He promises mom it's throwback, the kind they swear won't pickle your judgment. And it does have a smell more like some weird-ass tea, less like skunk. He only smokes if it's just him or he's only with mom, though I don't think she smokes. Austin would never smoke with clients and all friends, he claims, plus even strangers you pass on the street, are future, if not past or present clients. So the whole basic world is a client. Sometimes I vexed him to turn it down. Maybe he does, by a margin that doesn't matter. He'll yell up the stairs, "Earplugs, dude," in that diluvian but who cares tone. And I'm like, what if I slept through something asteroidal? Austin says, don't be melodramatic. He says I'm a doomseer, too typical of my generation. He says it lightly in a faux jokey voice. But when he doesn't think I'm in earshot, I've heard him refer to Generation F, failure, fatalist. Take your pick. If you want to get poetic, flotsam, others call us Generation NL, out loud, nil. No life, as in having no lives worth living, or maybe as in get a life, which it's true a lot of us cannot seem to do, or not according to some fossil definition of grown up, as in going out there to be something. People who are hard on us like that tell us to look at the kids who came of age in the pandemic years, the ones who survived and even somehow figured out how to live lives of their own while ducking in and out of lockdown during the surges. Austin, who has no kids genetically his own, says our allergy to independence, that's what he calls it, is the fault of our parents, but collectively, not individually, because he wouldn't want to get mom too far down. I was 12 when she married Austin, so there wasn't much he could do, he says, except root from the sidelines, as if me and mom were some kind of sporting event. It's so obviously not her fault that I boomeranged home, that I'm in this state she sees as deep limbo, but she's always felt responsible for who I am. I think she can't help feeling guilty about us losing dad, which is nuts, but I get it. Maybe it's also middle age and the whole mortality thing. She's in this fragile place right now. I guess we are doomsayers, me and my friend Noam and the rest of us, but why shouldn't we be?
If you're just tuning in, this is Between the Covers on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. So I think I counted 8 main narrators, as well as interspersed omnisciently narrated chapters, and also secondary characters like the dumper spouses.
You know, one of the, again, this is another of the pros of writing forward in the dark and not planning things out. Characters surprise me. I mentioned earlier that Austin was the appointed protagonist of the novel I originally conceived. And, you know, he has a voice, but he is definitely not one of the primary protagonists. In fact, someone told me, you know, he's kind of boring. I said, well, he leads a very controlled life. I mean, partly because he has this terrible folly in his past, but also he's successful and he has a reputation around town, and you can sort of picture he's very fashionable and goes to the yacht club and so on. So Austin wasn't, you know, the more charismatic one. In fact, Brecht, who emerges as such an important voice, if never in a million years would I have intended to have someone that young be so important, because I'm actually pretty terrified of writing about younger, cooler people. I'd far rather write about somebody who's in their 90s than somebody who's in their 20s. Of course, now I'm in my 60s, so I'm closer. So saying that is not, I'm farther from my 20s. But, you know, and one of the things, and you get a little hint of it there with Brecht, is that language is evolving in the mouths of the very young. And so there are some slang words that he'll use throughout the book that, you know, the adults, you know, don't use so much because he is in you know, in that generation that is shaping, you know, the next generation of English. So Brecht is very important. And also I spoke about the marine biologist, Mike, who's very important, and his wife, you know, leaves him for the husband of someone else. And they are two couples well-known in the sort of yacht club society. So it's quite mortifying for both of them. And of course they wonder, did everybody know their spouses were having this affair? And of course, fortunately, the spouses split, they leave town. But Margot is someone I suddenly found a great deal of pleasure in. She's retired from being the English teacher at the public high school that, I think as I put it, every child dreads they're going to have and every parent wants their child to have. She makes you memorize, she makes you, you know, do Shakespeare soliloquies. But, you know, outside the classroom, she kind of swears like a sailor, and she is in a rage. Mike, whose wife has left him, is kind of depressed. But Margot is a fury. And she, you know, and I sort of wondered to myself, I don't know how plausible this is, but then I really loved it as I wrote about it. She just basically shows up at Mike's house and takes him by the scruff of the neck and says, you know, you are not going to sink into, you know, some sort of depressed oblivion. You know, we're going to get our revenge. We're going to take them for everything they're worth. And they both have grown children. And Mike's relationship to his grown daughter and son also became very important, so that even Mike's son, who's a gay struggling actor in New York and keeps his father awake at night as his father thinks of him living in this dangerous city. New York is increasingly dangerous, but it's still very glamorous. It's still a hub of the arts. And his son is 30 years old and still trying to make it as an actor. And then at some point I decided we're going to actually not only meet the son, but we're going to hear the son. So the son has a secondary role in the narration as well. Not as important as his father, but, and then of course, you know, the danger that Mike and many people believe is beyond the town borders, suddenly it's right there on their doorstep. And of course I won't give away how that happens, but the climax of the book are the events on a very, very dramatic day when a lot of people's lives are suddenly in very grave danger. And Petra, I read a little bit of her, you know, I knew she was going to be important, this woman who also was in love with the woman that the very young woman that Austin was married to years and years ago in New York. And she, you know, shows up. I mean, her mission is a little deranged, you know, but she's in a state of denial that she's really, that she should be mourning the loss of her wife, Carly, who was a wonderful woman. So, you know, people who are listening to this interview are like, there is no way I'm reading a book with so many people. But, you know, the thing about my characters is, I promise, you know, I always, the guarantee I have for my readers is that you will be very fully grounded in each of my most important characters. I have to say that one of the greatest compliments to me is that a lot of my fans are psychotherapists. Why? Because I drill down so deep into my characters. If you do not like flashbacks, then please don't buy my books, you know, because every character's history, you know, here's something that emerged that I found, sometimes I actually cry a little, like, and authors will say, if you can't make yourself cry at scenes where you want the reader to cry, then what good are you? And if you also, if you can't turn yourself on when you write a sexy scene, what good are you? But there's a scene that I never thought I'd write about how Margot, this high school teacher who Egon, Mike's gay son, had as a teacher, and how in a very indirect way, she is the person who helped him come out.
Oh, I love and that scene. I love that scene. I cried at that scene.
He's playing, you know, Henry Higgins, you know, Professor Higgins in Pygmalion, and she's asking him how he reads Higgins' relationship to women, you know, is he drawn to women, or and in that conversation, and I, you know, that's, you know, one of those moments when a writer, when you feel like you're in the zone, because the scene is just happening, you sat down to, and you just didn't know you were going to write this scene, and they're sitting in this high school classroom, you know, and I just, I loved that scene. I loved writing that scene. Eight narrators. You know, my novel, The Widower's Tale, has four.
I was going to say, they seem to be going up. Is this your highest?
Yes. As far as protagonists, if you consider them, you know, maybe alpha and beta protagonists. Yes, those protagonists. And certainly the most first-person narrators. I'm famous for mixing first-person with third-person. And I, you know, some people think you can't do that. And in this one, I just, you know, I actually moved around the order in which people appeared several times, which is complicated because the present action of Vigil Harbor is only a few days.
The whole thing elapses in a few days,
It's really, so every time that I decided, no, I want the reader to hear, say Margot before they hear Mike, it would mean that if I swapped, because I'm going chronologically, I had to change whose point of view you would get the current moment through. So you know, really, you know, I think of this book as kind of Cat's Cradle, you know, that game with the string, that writing it was like playing Cat's Cradle, because every time I changed something, you know, or added a character, it would have this effect on the rest of the structure. I mean, in a way, the break that I had because of COVID paralysis in early 2020 gave me, it was a gift in a way, because it meant that I wasn't looking at the book for a period of months. And in some ways, I mean, not only was I able to figure out how COVID would
fit
this book, but I saw structural things that I wouldn't have seen as clearly if I had been just continuously working on it.
Our guest today is Julia Glass, speaking to us about her newest novel, Vigil Harbor.
Vigil Harbor falls into a genre that I've only learned since teaching. You know, now I'm learning all the vocabulary for.
Is there a name I don't know about?
Speculative fiction, right? Speculative, because speculates, right? But I joked to I was actually talking to the writer Karen Russell, who lives in Portland.
She's one of our beautiful Portlanders.
Such a lovely woman, and I won't claim we're close friends, but we have corresponded, and I had her come to Emerson and speak to our students, and she was amazing. But I wrote her an email and I said, well, I'm writing a speculative novel, if you can believe it, Karen, but I said, it's baby steps speculative. And she loved that. She wrote me back, go baby steps. I mean, you know, it's fiction in an interesting place right now. Partly because you're seeing the broadening of what is considered literary fiction, the sort of hybridizing of genres. And, you know, some people are referring to Vigil Harbor as what's called cli-fi. And, you know, climate fiction, sci-fi, cli-fi. And I kind of cringe at that because, again, that sounds so heavy-handedly political, and that's not what I intend. But, you know.
But that is realism right now. It's not, you're not making a giant leap. That's what I felt like, is this is the background within which these relational events are happening. Either you would be denying it if you weren't attending to it. I mean, like, so much of the book. I was going to ask an early question about one of the things you do so well is talk about place. And the book opens with an omniscient narrator speaking about Vigil Harbor and the
history of the town and the
history of the town, but also just about geography as
destiny.
As destiny, exactly. Exactly. And that you take that up, that is how you open the book.
Where you live. You know, whether you chose to live there, weren't able to leave. I mean, who can't be haunted by the thought of what it means to be a Ukrainian, to live in a country that is invaded by a bully, that is, you know, bombed to the ground? I look at these pictures of farmers, you know, in the heartland of Ukraine and their farms destroyed. And I just, you know, we never know, you know, and a huge mother of a storm could hit this peninsula I live on, and, you know, I mean, Marblehead, I mean, I'm a sucker for antique houses. I live in an 1820 house, but this house is one of the youngest houses on the block. Marblehead actually has more houses built before 1776 than any town in America. So you have all these cheek by jowl, crickety old wooden houses, and it's a miracle they haven't burned to the ground. They haven't been blown away. And every time that a big nor'easter hits, and as I said, we're raised up, which is great from the point of view of the waves crashing, but from the wind point of view, it's, I lie in my bed at night, it's kind of scary, but you reassure yourself. You say, well, this house has been standing since 1820, so I'm fine. But, you know, that's what we all tell ourselves, right? Well, everything's been okay so far, so things have got to continue to be okay, right? Going back to place, I mean, also, I told you that the title of this book until a few months ago was In a Time of Tempests. And You know, my editor tends to, I'm not great at titles. I tend to choose kind of florid titles. And my joke about that title is it's sort of like that really dramatic, colorful dress that you bought, but you kind of begin to realize you look more like a clown than elegant when you put it on. So my editor's very nice, and she said, you know, do you want to think about this title? Because is it really the title you want? And I said, oh, you know, I love, there's kind of a Shakespearean allusion, and I love that, you know, it tells people that it's dramatic. You know, you think storms, typhoons, hurricanes. But then I realized, you know what this book is about? This book is about a place. It's about a place and the forces that it exerts for good and for ill on the lives of the people who live there. And I said, it belongs to the family of novels that are titled with a place. And I thought Vigil Harbor, you know, that's a fine title. And in fact, a writer friend of mine wrote me last week and said how much he loves the title because he feels like it captures in two words where we are now. And I can't reproduce what he wrote. He's brilliant. And he said it's one word, you know, vigil is we are living in this moment of witness and warning.
You right, know, trepidation and hoping to survive, yeah.
Perilous world, we are on vigil, but we remain a harbor. We still care for one another. We are in a place of if we're lucky, if we're fortunate, where we are kind of holding together. And that's, you know, a harbor is a place where you come home, where, you know, you sail home to safety. And you don't want to really fully recognize your themes until, you know, maybe when you're pretty far into the book, so you can bring them out into focus. But, you know, I'm about to go out and meet readers, and readers tell me things that I'm just, that are jaw-droppingly true about my own work.
So if I could segue into a question from that. So one of the things you've said about your first novel, about Three Junes, is that that later you were able to look back on it, and that it was written just after in your 30s, where you had a really rough, brutal time with multiple losses and illness, and that looking back on it, you realized that Three Junes was really about unbearable heartbreak and what happens afterward.
Right.
Do you have any sense of sort of what your psyche was metabolizing during the writing of this book, especially now that you've helped us understand it was a decade that included some pretty intense American
massive changes in our world,
yeah.
Politically. You know, when I look back on Three Junes coming out of that triple whammy that I had, and I'll just say for those who don't know that within the period, a period of a year, I went through a divorce, a diagnosis of cancer, and the loss of my sister, my only sibling, to suicide. In fact, she killed herself less than 2 weeks after I was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was 36 years old. And, you know, I had actually written a short story about a widow, Scottish widower, that is really the seed for Three Junes. But then I went forward and I suddenly found myself writing about New York in the plague years, the worst years of the AIDS crisis, during which I had done volunteer work. So I met men who were dying. And somehow that entered the book in a way I hadn't expected. And only much later did I realize that it was this skewed way for me to write about my own enormous fears of mortality and my crippling grief, because it really was crippling for a while, over the loss of my wonderful sister. And so now, you know, I'm older, and at least, you know, knock on wood, you know, I'm healthy. I'm, you know, my grown children are facing their challenges, but they're healthy and they're doing as well as they can be. Sometimes I wonder, you know, am I going to become a glib writer because I'm, you know, living through horrible tragedies. But I think one of the things that really runs through this book like a spine is the fear of every parent now. Uh-huh. What the generations to come, that the existential lie awake at night fear and anxiety that those of us who are parents have about what is the future going to hold for our children. And if, and there are times, you know, when my older son will say to me, you know, your generation really screwed this world up. He uses a different word, of course, but I hope we can use that word that I used, you know, and look at what you did, you know, and what have you left us? And it's really sort of undeniable. I mean, what can I say? We're trying, you know, some of us are trying to make up for what we did, but there, sometimes he expresses a level of despair that it's hard, it's hard to counteract. But, you know, I'll say something. I think I was actually, I pulled a book off my shelf the other day called The World According to Mr. Rogers. And it's all quotes from Mr. Rogers. And there's one in there, I think this is where I saw this. And it was about when a child witnesses on television or in life something really terrifying and catastrophic. And I think of the fact that I had a five-year-old in Lower Manhattan on 9/11. And he says, when your child is looking at all this terrifying stuff, tell them, look for the helpers. There are always helpers. And that moved me so much. There will always, you know, whatever dangers we go through, there will always be those who are there to help. You know, when the younger generations despair, you know, but they still want to have their families and they still want to find ways to be optimistic, you know, look for the helpers and let's be the helpers. I don't want to be corny, but and if I look back on what my, you know, triple whammy in my 30s, you know what? That's the period in my life that turned me into an optimist. It's the tragedies and getting through them that made me an optimist.
That's a lovely way for us to sort of come in for a landing. Anyway, it was a joy to spend time with you, Julia. Thank you so much.
I'm so glad that this auction brought us together.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll talk again.
I hope so. I would love to.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Between the Covers here on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM with original music from John Bechtel. If you'd like to hear the longer version of this talk, head to kboo.org. I'm never been a gambler.
Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy jueves 19 de mayo del 2022.